Good morning and welcome to Casual London Dining Part 2.
And you, of course you're listening to Ann and Peter Haig at On the Menu Radio.
I was just going to say that.
You were turning things around. I just thought I'd put you in the right order or close to it. Now, this is a slightly different casual, I think. But I have a question for you. Is French ethnic? If French is ethnic cuisine, then this is ethnic casual this week. Because we have London's first Peruvian restaurant coming up just a little bit later. And who's up first?
The wonderful Spanish restaurant.
Fabulous Spanish that undoubtedly classes ethnic.
And Les Deux.
Les Deux Salon, which is owned by two wonderful characters. Will Smith, who's obviously very English, and his partner, whose last name is Demetre, which I think is...
French.
Well, I think it's actually not French. I think it's something. I think it's something different.
We talk about
something
that,
different, hopefully. Like Greek. But their restaurant, Les Deux Salons, as you probably guessed, is definitely French. So starting out then, first up we have Jose Pizarro, owner of two restaurants, not just one. One, a tapas restaurant called Jose, which we didn't go to, and a wonderful, fine dining casual establishment in a very casual part of London called Pizarro. So here's Jose.
We happen to love Jose Pizarro, but you say Paro.
Pizarro.
That's Castilian, no?
It's Castilian, South Castilian. It's Extremadura.
Yes, which is not Madrid.
It's no Madrid. It's southwest of Madrid.
And that's where you were born and trained. And here, the first time we met you, you had your first cookbook out, and you're about to come out with the second one. So you're very prolific here. But you also, you had a restaurant for years in the Borough Market, and you've worked all kinds of places. But now you have two restaurants, almost side by side, in London. And we haven't eaten at the tapas bar yet, but I'm ready. We ate at Pizarro's. And we had fabulous food. I mean, you're just so good, and thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I'm so proud. I'm so happy.
You have dreams.
And my dreams came
true. And you have your dreams come true.
My dream was to, like every chef, I think, the name outside.
So one is Jose, and the other one is Pizarro.
But I have a middle name, but I'm not going to use it.
Oh, okay. You're not going to... And listeners, it's not S, it's Z, P-I-Z-A-R-R-O. And if you don't know this man's cooking, you're going to have to get to know it because it's just right spot on, Jose. We just so enjoyed this meal.
It's just simplicity. It's quality.
It's quality above all. I mean, you can be very simple and not have the quality, but let's start with the fact that I don't know who designed this place, but it's the kind of environment that it's exciting, it's vibrant, and yet it's very comfortable. And who did the design here?
It's one of my business partner, me, is the one with it, all the design and all the, because I have to go with myself as well, have to have my personal thing there. It's so important. When you have your name outside, need to be you, have to be you.
So you
not just the cooking,
to
have to be all everything there.
But you wanted it to be relaxed, but still, absolutely. It's very, very sharp.
Like my cooking, have to be very simple, but you need to enjoy. You need to have fun. About my restaurants is to enjoy and have fun.
Yeah.
I don't want people sit down in front of food and don't say nothing. I need the people smiling, having fun. You know, it's not just about the food. It's about everything there. Staff.
Well,
the
you
staff
were doing very well.
Very well training.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who comes here, but they seem very pleased to be here. And they look to be thoughtful food types, but interesting. Some of them professionals, some of them, who are they?
I think because the range of my price, you can come here, everyone can be here, you know. I have city boys, I have wife with a husband and the little baby, I have students. I think a restaurant have to be for everyone, not just for very, very, people with a lot of money, People need to be able to eat my food.
Well, I mean, I was able to eat a lot of it, unfortunately. Oh, a lot.
Yeah, we did. This is Peter. I wasn't going to say anything, but I observed a couple of things that I thought were really interesting. First of all, there was the lady with the red jacket and the black skirt who came in and with a friend and went straight away to one of your three booths.
The banker.
Yeah.
As though she owned it. So perhaps she's been here more than once before.
I think she's coming in one or another, minimum three times a week.
Okay, right. And she was holding forth, I could tell from all the hand gestures. I couldn't hear what she was saying. But the most intriguing thing, and I didn't get a chance to ask you about it, so I'm going to mention it to you on the fly. You can actually drink your way around one of the tables because it's made out of wine boxes.
Yep.
Now, have you ever thought of actually doing a taste around the table?
Maybe we can start with that.
Put a glass on the Muga case, a glass on the
Vega Sicilia or Penguin. Yeah, maybe it can be a very good idea.
Because there's some great Spanish wines here. We discovered an old friend.
Mm-hmm.
An old
you
friend
say that?
Wine called Valenciso.
Valenciso.
I don't know, Ciso or Ciso. From the Rioja. Well, we actually met the owners at their winery before it was even open, and the wine was delicious.
It's amazing. It's a proper Rioja.
They only make one wine. They make a Reserva, and that's all.
Why?
Just one kind.
The thing about Spain, we just...
That's what I said there. I mean, a lot of people are like that.
Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt them. Back to you.
Oh, and you also have a sherry bar. I thought I'd mention that.
Yeah.
Tell us about the sherry bar.
Always I want to have my own sherry bar, a tapas bar, just to enjoy with my friends. It's tiny. It's like a proper Spanish tapas bar that you have in all corners, you know? It's a place like a pub here in London. People just go there and enjoy a drink, some food. It's a very sociable space.
Well,
it's very simple food, but I think the...
You say it's simple. Okay, it is simple, but there's something special about every single dish. You know, I don't know how you explain that except for your own talent and experience. We sat down to absolutely wonderful bread, crusty, rustic bread with a sort of, you said it was like a cauliflower ceviche, cauliflower and vinegar.
Escabeche.
It's what?
Escabeche.
Escabeche. And I was perfectly happy to just have that. But then you send out the, tell everybody about, because you know so much about the jamón bolota.
Jamón ibérico, 100% bellota. Okay. The ham that you have on the table. Exactly. Hams is quite many different ones around. And of course, for me, and in my place, I wanted to have the best.
And that is?
And it is. It's 100% ibérico.
Ibérico.
Jamón.
Jamón.
100% bellota. That means acorns.
Acorns.
These animals are wild animals, and in the last 4 or 5 months, they eat just acorns. They are wild animals running around in the winter, in the cold, eating acorns, grass,
they must be very
mushrooms,
happy.
And even mouse around. They are happy pig and very expensive. One animal, when they go to the fields, weighs around 100 kilos. When they are going to the butcher, they go until 180, 200 kilo. That means can go over 50% weight in 4 months. Eating acorns.
They're pigs.
They're eating like a pig.
And they eat a lot of acorns. Huh?
A lot of acorns, around 15 to 20 kilos a day.
First of all, you start out with the breed, which is really special. Then they're treated really well, and they get to eat all these acorns. And then you told me, how long is this aged?
These amazing hams are hanging for 4 years.
That's been incredible. I don't know how anybody...
And never been in a fridge, ever.
Now, why is it that they could do that?
It's the quality, it's the fat. I don't know how they keep it. Well, I know, because I've been there quite often, no?
You're mentioning about the smell. I mean, I think walking into one of these places is just the most incredible aroma.
Incredible. And it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And doesn't smell something rancid or something off. It's sweet. It's a nutty smell.
Wonderful.
And that smell goes through as well to the meat. It's really nutty, sweet, just, it's heaven.
But now you've managed to add, you start with the quality stuff, but you always add some little touch. Now, I've had a lot of croquetas. I mean, every place you go in Spade, you get croquetas. Yours were really good. Mm-hmm. Now, you do them with blue cheese, but they're something, they're very light. What did you do to make them so light?
The bechamel is very important, really light. You need to have very good balance between the butter and the flour.
Oh, you mean this was not low fat I was eating?
No, no, Matt. But you need to get very good balance, because then we add, today, were blue cheese and ham, but the day before was prawns. Another times is a white crab and basil croquette.
Oh, that sounds good.
That's are stunning. The thing is, because like we said before, we have so many customers coming back. I want to give to them always something a little bit different. Like the croquettes. If you are coming here every day and you are eating every day ham croquette, you get bored. It's why one day is one thing, another day another thing. Just to bring the people something
different.
Well,
I just think they were extraordinary.
But just the good balance and then the cremosity, the silky inside, they are very silky and very crunchy outside.
Yes. Yeah, they're light and silky. Mm. So, oh, I love them. Then we had also something else I had never had. You cure salmon with beetroot and serve it with capers and an egg yolk.
Yeah.
Now, there's special curing about the salmon besides the beetroot. Tell us about that.
It's giving some very good, nice and sweetness flavor to the salmon.
But you said there are different parts of the salmon.
Yep. A salmon, you have different parts. One is the tail, and always it's going to be less fatty, because always the animal is going to use a lot. Then it's going to be less fat. Mm? The loin is a bit fatter, and then you have the belly and the taro. And all of them are different fat, fatty, and the flavor is including different. It's why I cut all of them in different ways and mix all together. Because when you chew one area, it's going to give you some texture and flavor, of course. It's so important, I think, that you try every single part of the salmon. If you just try the tail, it's going to be drier than the belly.
But you never had it with... you say that's a tradition or not a tradition?
Not really
the egg
a tradition.
You made it up.
Yeah.
Well, but you created it. You didn't make it up. You created it.
The thing is, when you think about salmon, really fatty fish... Oily, not fatty, oily. Mm-hmm. And then you mix with egg. It's quite fatty. This thing is not going to work. But works. I think and works very, very, very well.
Yeah, Peter was eating it all up. He was gobbling.
Well, of course I was.
It's good.
Now, we did, I asked you a question about this too. You did a superb black rice with prawns and...
Prawns and aioli.
Which is garlic.
Garlic mayonnaise. Very simple. Normally they use in east of Spain, sorry.
But I wanted to know why were the prawns so strongly prawns?
Because they are no farm. They are
they're
a prawn
wild.
Like exactly. And they have flavor. So many people like you say, these prawns taste something different. They say, no, they are like Sulbia prawn.
They're supposed to be what it's like.
Exactly. So many customer, this cheese is amazing. I never tried something like that. He said, because it's proper goat cheese. A farm, small producers, just like food should be.
So tell us about the big giant prawns you're going to get.
Going
to cost a half a month's wages.
It's a prawn from Palamos.
Which is where?
The Palamos in Catalonia, northeast of Spain. It's going to cost like 20, 25 pounds each for 170 grams. And
you mean that's going to cost you or your customer?
Yeah, it's going to cost the customer. But I'm losing money because, not losing money, always I'm going to win the money. But it's going to cost me around 15 pounds, one prawn. I'm going to get like 10 pounds maybe. But the flavor and the texture, the color, they're red. Carabineros is just something unbelievable.
Now, this is a prawn that in its native state is like a form of marine transportation. So if you're trying to cross a river, you can hitch your ride, on a prawn.
It's,
so people will buy one prawn.
I hope so. I don't know. Maybe I need to eat all myself because anyone is going to buy.
Well, how are you going to fix something that's so precious to start with?
How? People have to try.
I mean, you know what you're going to do with it. How are you going to cook it?
A simple adjust plancha. Hot plate with some olive oil.
Oh, Jose, can I have one of those?
You need when to come back.
When will you have them?
I think it's going to be next week on Monday.
Yeah, they're not here yet. We're going to miss them.
We'll miss the plane. We're going to have the prawn.
Yeah, but we didn't miss the pork cheeks, and we didn't miss the bacalao.
We had the bacalao, the salt cod with white beans, really high quality white beans. Mm-hmm. That's another thing, and chorizo. And then this melt-in-your-mouth pig's cheek, you said you cook how long?
4 or 5 hours.
4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, really slow. Marinate the day before. 24 hours marinate with red wine, and vegetables. And the next day, just fry them and cook slowly. To keep the moist inside.
Yeah. And
tastes amazing.
Then you brought, which that's close to my heart. I don't know why more chefs and restaurateurs don't do that, is you brought the most marvelous green leafed salad with the endive on it.
I think it's so important people eat greens.
Yeah, me too.
If you don't give away with your meal, people never will buy.
Oh, I do.
But it's rare to see people eating greens. And for me, it's so important. For myself, in the end of the meal, nothing better than a green salad.
Yes, yeah,
it's so important.
I usually have to ask.
It's very important for yourself, for your health.
Well, I can tell you is that if we lived closer, I'd be here 3 times a week as your customer does. And I wish you the best of luck with both restaurants.
Thank you.
And also with your new book, which is going to be called...
You're going to come and join us again very soon, I think.
I would love to be there again.
Right.
I'd love to.
You must just let us know when, I think it's May sometime.
17th of May is going to be the day of the launch.
And it will be called...
Spanish Flavors. Spanish Flavors.
Again, it's just always a delight to see
it's
you.
It's always
thank
so,
you so
good
much.
To be with you, amigos. Amazing. And thank you very much for all your support. And really appreciate that.
Muchas gracias.
Gracias. And see you... Hopefully next year.
Hopefully. Yes, indeed. If not sooner.
And I will keep one prom for you, Chief. For sure.
And we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
We are back, as we promised, and where did we say we were going next? We're going to
Les Deux Salons,
which actually does mean two rooms, and this here's an upstairs and a downstairs, in a most convenient location, very close to Trafalgar Square, and really excellent fun, great French bistro.
Is it
brasserie? Cuisine.
Brasserie is a different thing, yes.
And,
every time they open a new place, a new concept, it's good. I mean, they just have an instinct for this. Well, we've been dancing with Will Smith and his partner, Anthony, for quite some time here. I guess from the very first of your restaurants, which we loved, Arbutus, however you want to pronounce it, it's a tree. And then Wild Honey, which we thought you couldn't do any better than Arbutus, and Wild Honey was even more so, and we loved it. Mainly, we're talking about modern British cuisine. And then you startled us. You turned over and started a whole new thing, Les Deux Salons, which is French bistro, right?
French brasserie.
Brasserie, right.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a bistro and a brasserie?
Well, there's a good question. A brasserie is usually an all-day long business. The food offering is maybe a little less a little less gastronomic, but a little more standard everyday sort of cooking. Usually they're large rooms. Yeah, offering all-day dining.
Okay.
Relaxed informality.
Well, this is a stunning space in that idiom. And you say it was a pub before.
Yeah, it used to be a pub. Had been here for about 10 or 15 years. And very much, it was a chain pub and very much,
really?
You know, pints of beer. And the food offering was very minimal. And I think despite its amazing location next to Trafalgar Square, which is not even 100 meters, the pub thing is changing in the UK, and people are demanding more in terms of food and offerings, and that whole vertical standing at a bar drinking pints of lager is slightly changing, especially in a huge room like this, and along with the smoking. The smoking ban, which came in, I suppose, about 4 years ago, that has really not helped pubs either. So chains like this, they lost their way a bit, and this group was selling it on, and we came across the site and had known the site anyway and just loved the building from the outside.
The location is so amazing. It's like you said, I mean, it's right in absolutely dead smack on where the most touristy place in London is.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We call ourselves...
But down a side street.
Well, exactly. We are to some extent off-pitch. It's not a premium pitch, exactly. It's a very busy little street, William the Fourth Street. But it's slightly off-pitch. But we call ourselves Covent Garden, and we come in WC2, which is Covent Garden postcode. But we are closer, really, to Trafalgar Square and Leicester Square than we are to Covent Garden Piazza, although they're all within 500 metres, really.
So your two salons would be the first floor is one and the second floor is two.
Precisely that. We always scratch our heads and argue about names of restaurants, and ultimately, once they're up and running, the name is important, but it's kind of not important. It's not going to put you off going to a place. But
Did you study French to do this?
Back to my school, O-level French. And not many people remember O-levels, but yes. Anthony is my business partner and the creative
French
chef side of things. And his partner is Parisian. And so she helped a lot with that.
Isn't his name French? Dimitri.
Now that, yes, it's actually Greek Cypriot. I think his father's side, his grandmother is Cypriot, so it's Dimitri.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So there we are. There. Yeah.
Now I'm right in tracing you both back to River Cafe, correct? Work together at River Cafe.
Oh no, not River Cafe. Across the river from River Cafe, Putney
okay.
Bridge Restaurant.
Okay.
Which was only probably a mile away from the River Cafe in Southwest London. That's pretty much where we first met, and we worked together for about 7 years there, running an iconic building there, which was right on the start line of the Oxford and Cambridge boat race. And that's sort of where we came up our business concept initially, to open Arbutus about 6 years ago.
Now, I mean, this is interesting with the, you put in the lighting that clearly wasn't in the pub, right?
we've put everything in here.
Everything.
Everything you see.
Even the glass ceiling?
Absolutely everything, yeah. The glass ceiling. And when you're, we're on the first floor, I should explain, but when you're back downstairs on the ground floor, you will see the mosaic floor. We put the mosaic floor in as well.
Oh, I read about your floor.
And it does look old, and it's sort of as we want it to start aging, and it's been there for
donkeys. Yeah, these mirrors aren't...
No,
vintage?
We put the mirrors in. It's all made to look vintage.
Wow.
Absolutely everything had to go in. I mean, it was literally a sticky floored beer smelling pub. There really was nothing to keep at all. So we had to start afresh. So it was a massive project for us compared to Arbutus and Wild Honey. We could probably physically in the space fit Arbutus and Wild Honey twice in this space.
So that is a big adjustment.
Big proposition, absolutely. So we brought in a very serious design team, and they were fantastic. A gentleman called Martin Brunitsky, and he's a genius in what he does. And we gave him a very strong brief for what we wanted. Anthony and I were very certain about we wanted the Parisian brasserie look and feel. And Martin, with our limited budget, although it became less than limited, but he was able to very cleverly keep within our restraints just about and produce the right look for us. Obviously, all along, being very careful when you're trying to imitate a style that you don't end up being too Disney and you know, feel a bit kitsch and tacky. And I think he's done a plus job actually with the space.
I think it's great. I liked the minute I walked in the door.
Yeah.
And I like the menu, but it's really huge.
Yeah, well, again, that's a brasserie thing. You see, there's got to be something for everyone there. Very different. We're very different to Arbutus and Wild Honey, our other two restaurants. At Arbutus and Wild Honey, we're changing the menu daily. We type the menu daily in-house. There are always specials. There are always things happening, whatever's coming from the market. Here, as you can see, the menu is a classic brasserie menu, a laminated piece of card, which clearly only changes every 2 or 3 months. Dishes are very consistent. And, yes, there is a big choice. There's probably 12 to 15 starters and likewise with mains.
Well, that leads me to, what are you going to recommend for lunch for us?
Oh, well, for me, a lovely light starter. I mean, we are Monday morning here, you see. You've probably got a long week of eating ahead of you, so maybe you want to start on the lighter side. A wonderful crab salad. Absolutely delicious. It is super. The white meat of the crab, some shavings of avocado, a little bit of crushed hazelnut in there, which gives some lovely crunch and texture, and some pink grapefruit, which gives a lovely citric burst to it. It's a really lovely combination of flavors, and light and delicious. And I suppose we are a brasserie. I think you should have the Mediterranean fish soup, one of you. The lovely, earthy, full-flavored Mediterranean fish soup. Gurnard, rascasse, things like that are in there. And we serve that with a little grated Gruyere and some Rui and croutons. And it's fantastic. And it's
That's
a real
sort of
classic brasserie dish.
Well,
as you're welcome to go off-piste and have anything else you like. Don't let me force you. Main course-wise, we've got wonderful bavette steak, which is a very classic French cut, the bavette. We call it the skirt steak in the UK, and it typically has been used as a stewing sort of cut, but we buy a fantastic quality bavette, which we just grill in our charcoal grill, which is called a Josper or Hosper charcoal grill. It's a Spanish grill. It's a bit like an indoor barbecue, essentially. It gives a lovely char to the meat, and the meat is absolutely delicious. And it's very classic steak frites, you know. You can't go wrong with that.
I see that you have a 5A rating for your andouille.
Well, the andouille. Now, don't ask me to repeat what the 5A's stand for, but it's something like the association of andouillette, etc., etc. Yes.
Yeah, Peter had it once, and I couldn't even get close enough to smell it.
I read about it. It was in that Quarterly Food magazine.
Right.
Very learned food magazine this gentleman put out. And I was intrigued because I like sausages. So we were going to Paris shortly thereafter. So I decided I would have to go in search of andouillette. And I had it once. And I don't think I would do it again.
You know what? You fall into two camps there. If you love offal and all those sort of things, then...
This
is made with big stripe, pig's intestines, and is very strong, very earthy, very pungent.
This is really
everyone knows at your table and the tables around you that you've ordered it.
Because it comes with its own, heavenly smell.
It does. I often say to people, I call it farmyardy or earthy, because it really is, and that's what you're eating there. And we love to have that on the menu because it's a very classic brasserie dish.
A
few a day, but we do we sell it every day, but we do a lot of covers every day. It's certainly not top of the list in terms of what's going to sell, but it's a great thing to have on the item. And some people come in and see it and go, I'm having that, because they know that's exactly what they want.
What about, it's not typical of a brasserie, but your sea bass?
Yeah, the sea bass is superb. Fillet of sea bass, just cooked on the plancha on a hot metal grill. Lovely crispy skin. And then we serve that with some Lyonnaise potatoes, which is just sauteed potatoes, really, with some caramelized onion through it. It's super. I love it. It's a great, very, very popular fish dish.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you do is daily special. So there's a Monday special, there's a Tuesday special, the same every week.
Absolutely. And that, again, is one of the ideas, one of the sort of brasserie concepts, if you like, is that you have a plat du jour every day, something different every day. So people know if they're coming on a Friday, they'll get the bouillabaisse.
That's what I wanted to...
Not today. Well, you can almost get it with the Mediterranean fish soup.
If I were here on Friday, that's what I would get. Or I'd like the lapin on Wednesday.
Monday is a chopped steak, but the word cheval is...
It's not horse meat, but the French do eat horse meat, so it could well be. It can be a bit confusing. Yeah, absolutely, they do. It's a cheval. It basically means steak haché à cheval. Is a bit like you say, a chopped steak with a fried egg on top, as if on horseback is the idea. And that's where the exclamation à cheval comes from. But yes, it can be a little misleading. So those plat du jour are very popular. And the idea, again, is that we're interested in people can pop in, have a plat du jour, a carafe of wine, be gone for £15-16. We're not all about getting a huge average spend here. It's about seeing people come in, try something, just something simple, come and go. It's meant to be very easy all-day dining.
Now, you have two private dining rooms here in the row. Upstairs, who books parties here? I mean, they're fairly large.
They are. I mean, one of them seats about 25 people, and one seats about 10. And local business people, lots of offices around us here. I mean, we are in the middle of central London here. We're very near the sort of main legal area where lots of the lawyers hang out, and the Crown Court's down the road, and lots of corporate finance and things like that. So, lots of that sort of business, but In the evenings, we might get anything from a retirement party to a birthday celebration. At the weekends, sometimes we do a christening even there, or people come and have their wedding breakfast afterwards, you know. So we get all sorts of people use that, and they're fantastic. They're at the front of the building, and they have natural daylight, which is wonderful, because a lot of private rooms don't have that. And they're a lovely space, and people really enjoy them.
I think they're beautiful, yes.
Now, this wouldn't be a complete brasserie if it didn't also have an interesting wine program. Talk to us a little bit about that, Will.
Well, one of our things about wine, you're absolutely right, it's very important. I think a lot of restaurants miss a trick. They consider the menu as being the main event, and the wine, well, we've got to have a wine list as well. And Anthony and I try and look very much from the business as both sides of it. The wine offering must be equally as important as the food. We offer just a short wine list, just 40 wines, 20 whites and 20 reds. All of them are open, and we sell everything by the carafe, which is something we do in our other two restaurants. So a third of a bottle carafe for a third of the price makes it very easy that people coming in at lunchtime, maybe you're a business person, you don't want a bottle, but equally you don't want a glass of the house Chardonnay or whatever it might be. You know, you can still have a carafe of a nice wine without having to spend a fortune. Although we are a French brasserie, we do take our wines from all over the world, though. We're very fortunate in the UK that we have the whole world's wine market at our feet here. So we go everywhere from Argentina, New Zealand, South Africa, obviously plenty of French, Italian, Hungarian. We're all over the place, which is great, and everything is equally sells well.
Well, now this is the third restaurant, but it opened in 2010, and by my internal clock, that means you should be working on your next one. What will that be?
What would that be? We are always looking out. We obviously talk with all the property agents, and they're always keeping us in touch with what's coming up on the market and what might be coming up on the market. Certainly these three restaurants keep our hands very full for the time being. We are looking at things. We have a possible idea that we want to do. We haven't signed any contracts at the moment, so I wouldn't want to speculate any further than that. But I would like to think that we'll be down the road with a fourth site later on this year would be the ideal proposition for us.
Okay,
yeah.
And you let us know.
We will, of course, let you know. The nature of our business, Anthony and I are tremendously busy, and we will always be busy, even if it was just the one restaurant. However, we have ambition, and I wouldn't say we get bored, but we like to challenge ourselves. We like to try new things. London dining scene is so dynamic. There are always new things coming along.
We can't even keep up with all
of them. No, there's always something new opening. Of course, a few places close. But generally, the standard is fantastic, and we like to be in the mix there. And, you know, we would only ever open something else if we felt it was commercial, if it was the right thing for the market. I know at some point in the future we will do something, although watch this space, shall we say.
Well, this is a big place. Can people just walk up, or should they really get a reservation?
No, you can just turn up, absolutely. And that again, is the whole point of a brasserie. Just wander in, lots of people just wander in and ask for a table. We can always find them a space. Like you say, it is a big space. It's over two floors. We've probably got about 60-odd tables. We can seat at once about 150 to 160 people. Of course, it gets full and it gets busy, but there's always a way around. And when you've got that sort of number of tables, there's always someone coming and someone going. So people just turning up, will always get a table. Even if maybe you have to wait 5-10 minutes in our bar.
Well, it was a delight to meet you, Will. We know you have to rush off, but do give Anthony our very best regards. And as soon as you can break the news, be sure to call us and let us know.
And, I will do indeed.
We'll save a spot in next year's London visit.
Yeah.
For whatever new place you have.
Absolutely, Peter. And lovely talking with you both. Thank you.
And we'll be Peruvian on the other side of the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here's a question. Next up is, the full title is the Ceviche, Peruvian Kitchen and Pisco Bar in Soho. Now, the question is, how many Pisco Sours could they get through? Not even the first one. But
no,
boy, I was an odd person out in this place. They were down in those Sours.
They sure were downing those Piscos, there's no doubt about it. And they were snuffing down the food pretty quick, too.
Yes.
And It's authentic Peruvian. Apparently, one of the challenges Martin Morales had in getting the project off his ground, working with his wife, was to get the right ingredients all the way from Peru. It is the first Peruvian restaurant of the real Peruvian nature in London. I think there are a couple of other places that pretend to be Peruvian that they aren't. And as you hear Martin Morales, who himself is a Peruvian transplant into London, speak about his restaurant Ceviche, you'll understand just exactly how much time and trouble and effort and what an end it is to his dream to actually have this place open and have people accepting it so readily as they did and as we did. So here's Martin Morales.
Everyone we talked to about coming to this new restaurant, Ceviche, in London, they got excited because there's so much buzz on the street. And I think you're responsible for this, Martin Morales. Tell us about Ceviche, the first Peruvian restaurant in London.
Well, it's been something that we've been wanting to do for over 10 years. I'm Peruvian, and I moved to the UK over 20 years ago. And it's a dream come true. It's not been without its challenges, because no one has ever done this before in this kind of way in London.
And the challenges with suppliers, like particularly.
Exactly. Getting the produce, getting the fresh ingredients from Peru, some of which are essential for our cuisine. And then also getting the site, the most beautiful site we could. And we have a restaurant in the heart of Soho, in a building that was built in 1735. So things like that, as well as raising the money. Something very simple, but very, very, very difficult in the current economic environment for a, who would have thought it, a Peruvian restaurant? Where is that from,
people say. Hello. I mean, who would have thought that was jam-packed upstairs? Well, I said upstairs because we were downstairs in the office. We got so quiet because the buzz continues inside. Everybody's so excited to be here, having a great time. And I guess they've also had a number of piscos, right?
It's long time coming for us that have been here for a long time. We have been actually very, very, very frustrating and almost angry for not having a great restaurant that's serving Peruvian cuisine, one of the best cuisines in the world, in London. We can't call ourselves a great restaurant nation and a great restaurant city if we don't have all the great cuisines represented, and Peruvian is one of them. So now we can. Now we have Ceviche in London. And yes, we can drink pisco sours, have ceviches, have tiraditos, have arroz con pato, our delicious rice and duck dish.
Yes, we've had these, and I think I'm going to have you run through some, because our listeners love to hear the details of all these dishes. You seem to have a lot of octopus pulpo in the menu, which is super delicious. Tell us what kinds of things you recommend, and the quinoa salad also. And the arroz con pato, the duck with rice. Tell us some more.
So we have what we think is the first ceviche bar in Europe, which serves right in front of you at the entrance of the restaurant, serves these freshly prepared ceviches with seafood and fresh sea bass, all locally sourced and sustainable. And also pulpo, octopus, thinly sliced sashimi style. We call that tiradito. And we make that with a delicious Peruvian olive sauce, which is, and a few capers. So that's a great dish as well. The pulpo al olivo, we call it. So that's our ceviches. We have also among the ceviches a sakura maru, which is named after the first migrant boat that came from Japan to Peru. And it's a Japanese-Peruvian-influenced dish, ceviche tiradito. Delicious, delicious, with salmon. And then we have a variety of other dishes. We have our anticuchos, which are...
They're skewers.
Are skewers, yeah. And the beef heart is the most traditional
one. We have that.
It was, yeah.
So if anybody's hesitant about it, I mean, it's really tender. It's not chewy like... beef heart if you make it at home.
Exactly. And we tenderize it with the marinade that we put in there, the Peruvian chili called ají panca, which is a smoky chili. We tenderize it with a touch of white vine vinegar and a little bit of cumin, a little bit of salt and pepper, a little bit of garlic. Just delicious and all sizzling coming from the barbecue, from the grill down here. But then we have the octopus one. You rightly said there's another octopus dish. And yes, I mean, we love our octopus. So.
How about the llama?
And then, you know, among the anticuchos, also we have our Peruvian Chinese-influenced dishes, the saltados, which means jumping, you know? So these jump out the pan.
Chinese influence?
Yeah. These are wok cooked.
That's true. It said that on the menu.
And a wok hob, you know? So a meter of fire coming out of the hob that's cooking and sort of roasting and smoking these dishes. So lomo saltado, our beef tenderloin with onions and tomatoes and a bit of cumin and a bit of ají amarillo, which is our yellow chili from Peru, very aromatic, are all part of the mix that makes that dish so juicy and delicious.
And it's so convivial. You get small plates if you want. I mean, large plates if you want to. But everybody shares around, and everybody's enjoying the company and the excitement of the whole thing. It's really caught on, hasn't it?
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, it's Soho. Has always been a village. Has always been a place for communal eating. Has always been a place for sharing. And it's, you know, it's a small little restaurant with a lot of love and a lot of care being put into it from the design and from the chefs that are making the food. And yeah, that's how we want it. We didn't want an exclusive place. This is not an expensive place. This is not a place just for millionaires or anything like that. We are on a mission to bring Peruvian food to the UK, but at the highest level, at an affordable price. And
you can see people coming in.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of tricks to this? I mean, opening hours or when?
Opening hours are 12 till 12, 7 days a week. We really want lunch to be an important part of what we're doing, and dinner. We'd love that little bit in between as well. So that's why we've decorated Ceviche in a way that's very down to earth. The front of the restaurant is great for solo diners because you've got the Pisco bar, which is our Peruvian spirit, and that's the only spirit we serve there. And we have our ceviche bar there, so you can hang at the bar, eat anything or drink anything off the menu, and you can do that. You can have one dish and a cocktail and come out having spent just under £10. It's great value for money, and you don't have to sit with anyone. You can just watch how the food and drinks are prepared in front of you, see who's next to you and have a chat, or you can book and sit at the restaurant at the back. So we wanted this place to be for conversation as much as for food and drink as well.
Now, you just mentioned something, because Soho is a very busy place, and evenings in particular, and close to the end of the week or through the weekend, so you recommend making reservations if you want to be seated at a table?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've got the front of the restaurant, which is our ceviche bar and pisco bar. It's walk-up, so you can come out and eat there, but it gets pretty busy pretty quickly, we're finding, just these first couple of weeks of opening. And then the back of the restaurant is all booked. It's all bookings. So, yeah, please try and book a couple of weeks in advance, and we'll do our very best to accommodate you. Sometimes there's tables at 5 p.m., sometimes at 10:30 p.m. But, yeah, just give us a call. Send us an email. welcome@cevicheuk.com. That's CEVICHEUK.com. And that's welcome@cevicheuk.com.
Those of you who are sophisticated about internet naming, that is not what I thought it was, .co.uk. It is exactly that, Ceviche UK, and it's a .com address.
I'll conclude this interview without having you explain, because you do it so eloquently. I mean, you've done so many other things. As you said, you introduced Miley Cyrus to Europe. You've had all kinds
Forgive
of experience.
Forgive me for that.
And all these other businesses, all of it, though, got chucked because this is your dream. And you don't take this lightly. I mean, you go back and forth to Peru. You study every dish. You want to do this right.
I want to do this right. This is my life. This is my future. This was always on the cards. This was always written.
And you're self-taught.
Miley Cyrus, Disney, Apple, iTunes, anything I've done before was the lead-up to this. My roots are my life and then my culture. And my mission on this planet is to bring our beautiful culture to other places outside of Peru. I don't care if we make no money at all. I just want our team to be happy and us to be a respectable business here in London. We're a small little restaurant behind a little black door. Inside is a really magical world where people say we're a family business. Our general manager, everyone thinks she's my wife, and she's beautiful and wonderful, and she's an amazing woman. So this is what we're trying to do, build a really nice team.
That was the lady you kept on telling us you were coming any moment.
Indeed, yes.
I just wanted everybody to get a sense that this is your dream.
Yeah.
And when they walk through that door, they're not only just going to get Peruvian dishes and that massive corn that's so wonderful, and potato cakes, and all the ceviche, of course, and piscos, they're going to get a good dose of Peruvian history.
Well, not only that, we're not there to preach. We're there to...
No, but you just know it all.
Yeah.
And it's part of you.
Yeah, and I think what we want to do is the place to ooze these things. The subtle way we present the menu to the subtle way we present ourselves. We're Soho as well, you know. We're London as well. And we've some of us have lived here half of our lives... As well as in Peru. And so we know how we swing here in London as much as in Lima. We want to bring that atmosphere. We don't want to bring a Disneyland of Peru over here. We are very embedded into our British and Soho culture as well. So, yeah, people enjoy it. And that's why we're friends with our neighbors. We've lived and worked here for 15 years, even though our restaurant has only been here for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Some of us know the neighborhood so well. So, no, it's an absolute pleasure to be serving food here in London at this little site in Frith Street.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have met you and to have experienced the community style of enjoying a different culture and wonderful food.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Anne.
And stay with us because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, says Peter.
Welcome back, says Ann.
There you go. I knew you were going to say that. And how are we going to finish out this program?
We ran out of restaurants that we ate at and interviews in London.
But here's a fascinating intersection for you.
Yeah, you have a connection to this. I have no idea.
I always have a connection because a very English ingredient is the wonderful vegetable, sometimes turned fruit, called rhubarb. But guess where rhubarb comes from? Rhubarb comes from the high plains or high deserts all the way from Chile through Peru to Ecuador. So there you go.
I thought we were going to talk about the English rhubarb triangle.
Well, no, we were not going to talk. We talk about the English rhubarb triangle in the interview, so we don't need to,
okay.
We don't need to really go any further than that. Remarkably, we found that a great outbreak of rhubarbism in the state of Minnesota, and a lady who's so passionate about it that she wrote a book called Rhubarb Renaissance. Peter used to think that Yorkshire, his native land in England, was the capital of rhubarb, but I just learned something new today. The capital of rhubarb in these United States is Minnesota. Kim Odie from Minnesota is here to prove that. Welcome, first of all, on the menu, Kim.
No, thank you.
How did it happen? How did rhubarb get to Minnesota?
Well, actually, rhubarb, I always thought it came from South Dakota. That's where I grew up, and it was on every garden around me, and I just thought, this is where rhubarb began. So it was took me by surprise to learn that it's actually from China, and its roots was as a medicine. And it was only as a medicine that it made its way through the Silk Road trade route to Europe and took hold in Scandinavia. And I think that must be the beeline that brought it to Minnesota. Good Scandinavian immigrants.
Yes. Yeah, they probably brought it with them. Now, separately, the story of how rhubarb dominates a part of the West Riding of Yorkshire used to be called the Rhubarb Triangle. He's lost on me. In fact, I didn't even realize that the sea of greenhouses near the train tracks between Huddersfield and Leeds was actually rhubarb. I really never thought about what it was. But this rhubarb that's grown there, the specialty is making it grow early in the spring by keeping it in greenhouses and hidden under some kind of mound of dirt so that when the rhubarb emerges, it's very delicate and very tender. Now, what you told us coming on the air is that it's everywhere in Minnesota and also South Dakota.
Well, it's very much a northern plant. In fact, it doesn't tolerate the southern humid climates so well. There are some southerners among my friends who had never heard of rhubarb until they moved here and couldn't figure out why people would be swooning over this pie that someone had brought to a potluck. It was kind of pinkish, greenish.
it's not the most attractive looking plant, is it?
Yeah, some of it is. Well, remember Thomas Keller's book on sous vide, cooking under pressure.
I don't remember.
Gorgeous cover was rhubarb. There Ruby red
oh.
rhubarb.
Oh,
yeah, did you know that?
Right.
But it's kind of...
He says know, that's a great way of cooking it, sous vide.
Yeah, but even in a pie, it's kind of strange looking with a sort of fibrous strands. And you almost have to get over that in order to realize how absolutely delicious it is.
And it's just that, you know, fiber is good for us. So we have to think, well, this is good for me. And this is where I think a little food gel is perfectly in keeping. I suspect this is where the predilection to pair rhubarb with strawberries came from.
Oh, yeah, to brighten the color. Huh?
Yeah.
Well, what does it do health-wise? It's so wonderful. I mean, I know there's legends about it uses the spring tonic, whatever that is.
Well, I think the spring tonic thing, there really is something to it. It's certainly one of the first plants up in the spring. It does have this stringency. It just tastes so fresh after winter of squash and beets and potatoes out of the root cellar. It has a lot of vitamins and minerals in them, sorts of, you know, iron and potassium and such. Vitamin K, which is not a vitamin I grew up ever knowing much about, but it apparently is very good for our brain.
Yes, I mean, a lot of things are...
That's why Minnesotans are also smart, I guess, because they eat lots of rhubarb.
Oh, absolutely, that must be it.
It's probably where my native intelligence comes from as well. I always wonder where it was. It must be rhubarb.
Well, the name of your book we haven't mentioned, by the way, is Rhubarb Renaissance, which in itself implies that there was a period when it wasn't as popular, and it is coming back in popularity now.
Oh, I think in the 1980s and the 1990s, it must have been extraordinarily unpopular.
Why?
I can't think Generation X's or whatever they're called, and you know, even baby boomers are suspicious of something that tastes like a fruit, but everyone tries to make them believe it's a vegetable. Sort of like it was done like they did a trade with tomatoes, right?
True. Yeah.
I mean, tomatoes really are a vegetable, except everybody says they're fruits.
it is how we regard them. And I know, Anne, I understand you're not a huge fan of sweets and desserts, and I think that's where the renaissance of rhubarb can come into play. It is botanically a vegetable, even though we think of it as a fruit. Uh-huh. And half the recipes in this book are about exploring its savory side, using it as you might use a condiment or a vegetable. And not just slathering it with sugar.
You know, I think your recipes are really fascinating.
Thanks.
Intriguing. If I had rhubarb, I think I'd even make some of them.
Here's a significant question we haven't asked Kim yet. Why did you decide to become the spokesman for rhubarb? I mean, did the Rhubarb Council have a competition for who would be their spokesperson? I mean, what happened?
I think I may have to invent the Rhubarb Council first. the Minnesota Historical Society here had, I've done another book for them on bread baking, and we were talking about, what's new and different and unheralded, but also very much a part of the northern Midwest culture. And rhubarb just came to the fore. And as soon as, you know, we said that, it was like, oh, because it has been forgotten. And I think your theory as to the baby boomers and the Gen Xers, I think there is truly something to that, that it was just, it was like, you know, our parents' Oldsmobile. That was our parents' go-to dessert. And frankly, I think we also lost our imagination around it. Rhubarb pie, rhubarb cobbler, rhubarb sauce, and then the train falls off the tracks. That's all we did with it.
Well, now you fixed that.
Because
now you can have rhubarb for beginners, rhubarb for appetizers, rhubarb for entrees, rhubarb for dessert, and rhubarb wine to wash it down with. I mean, what else is there left?
How about soft-shell crabs?
Yeah, soft-shell crabs and rhubarb.
I haven't tried that, but I'll put money on the table right now. It would be delicious.
Really?
Because one of the great revelations started, you know, fiddling with different combinations was how wonderfully rhubarb pairs with fish and shellfish. I think it's the sweetness of, there's an appetizer that has a shrimp paired with a rhubarb compote. And my husband says, don't you need to test that recipe again? Really? You know, are you sure? Because he
likes it.
He loves them.
He's a rhubarb freak as well.
Well, he has been very, he's been a good sport about this.
Well, you know, kale is the other thing. It's just having a great surge in popularity. So you hit both bases with a confetti salad of kale and rhubarb. Now that sounds great.
Now just be careful of the rhubarb leaves, though. This is not an old wives' tale, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
No.
We better separate
them out. That's true. You know, and growing up, we were always told, you know, we would be shooed out to the garden to pick the rhubarb, but don't eat the leaves. They're poison. And to a child, poison sounds very serious.
Yeah,
and so we were, you know, very, you know, careful. Just, you know, we hardly dared touch them, and, you know, we couldn't feed them to the hogs. We'd have to, you know, throw them in the ditch. And I was speaking to a doctor the other day, and he had been looking into this as well, and he hasn't been able to find a case of someone actually dying from eating rhubarb leaves. But it certainly sounds like it wouldn't be a pleasant experience. There is a toxin.
Uh-huh.
And it reacts with our stomachs. I think you'd have a pretty bad stomach ache.
And what is
but
that
yeah, you know,
thing?
They look so beautiful.
What is that thing that grows up and you have to cut off? I never understood that either.
Oh, when it goes to seed. Yeah, that's its seed pod. And it will just, arise out of the plant. Now, there's a theory that the best rhubarb for rhubarb wine is picked after the plant has gone to seed. Something about the sugars start to behave differently in the plant. Some people will say you need to stop harvesting after it's gone to seed. Frankly, I just cut off the seed and keep eating rhubarb.
There you go. I think the next thing to take on, and if I had the right contacts and the right quantity of rhubarb, I would do this. You have to have somebody making rhubarb-flavored vodka.
Oh.
That would be good. Now you're talking.
That's good.
Right? Yeah, that would be great cocktail.
That would be really good.
You'd really get the mixologist.
As long as you didn't put too much sugar in it.
Yes. You know, there's a business in Rochester, New York, Fee Brothers Bitters, and they make a variety of flavored bitters. And one of them is rhubarb bitters. I found a bottle, tried it in a few cocktails. It's acquired a taste as bitters are. Rhubarb bitters are an even more acquired taste.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah, okay. So you tried it, so you need more simple syrup the next time.
Well, all in the name of research.
Yeah.
There you go.
Now, Kim, you are a feature writer for the Star Tribune. What do you cover usually?
Rhubarb. He's the rhubarb correspondent.
There we are, yes. I am what they call a general assignment feature writer. So I come in every day not really knowing for sure what might be on my plate, which is what I've always enjoyed, just the serendipity of life throws at you. And I've also been fortunate enough to do some writing for our food section here, which is kind of exercises the other side of my brain.
We're so glad that you decided to revive rhubarb. I'm not going to comment on the recipe that you have in the book called Yorkshire Rhubarb, because it's not like anything I ever heard of. But I'm sure all the other recipes are wonderful, and listeners, you'll surprise yourself, assuming, of course, that you can find a source for rhubarb.
Well, if you can't find rhubarb, I think you put the word out along your neighborhood and, like, talk about zucchini. You know, the rule in Minnesota is never leave your car windows down in late summer. Because your front seat will be full of zucchini. Same thing with rhubarb. You know, keep those windows rolled up.
you are a funny lot in Minnesota. You have a wry sense of humor in Minnesota. It must be something to do. Must be something to do with the weather.
Isn't this? Wasn't who was our food writer for a long time in the PG who did the Falling Water cookbook? Wasn't she from Minnesota?
I thought she was from the state of Washington, but
no. Uh-uh.
Okay. Beats me. I've forgotten.
Maybe someone in Wisconsin?
She was from Wisconsin.
That's not Minnesota. That's different.
She was from Minnesota.
She
wasn't
was.
She?
I don't remember.
Yes, the time.
Okay.
She could have been from anywhere. Norwegians spread out all over.
Yeah. But
we do spread out.
Like the Odies. And you have to be careful these days, though. Because there are guys packing weapons back in Norway, so you have to be careful where you
boy,
look.
That's scary.
Oh, isn't this awful to hear?
It's just awful. You see, the problem was he didn't have enough rhubarb in his system.
Well, maybe we should have fed him the leaves.
Yes, that's a good idea.
It's not too late.
Well, Kim, this has been a delight. And
oh, no, this is wonderful. I thank you so much for your interest, and you guys are a fun pair.
I guess we've been called that before.
Okay, thank you again so much.
Thanks, Kim.
Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.